Welcome to New Books in Sociology, a podcast where we interview authors of influential and interesting books in the field. Thank you for joining us today. I'm your hostess, Annie Sepukaya, and this week we are interviewing Stephanie Coates, a professor of history and family studies at the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. She is also the co-chair and director of public education at the Council on Contemporary Families. Her most recent book is A Strange Stirring, The Feminine Mystique and American Women at the Dawn of the 1960s, published by Basic Books in 2011. But today, we will actually be talking to her about an older book called The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap, also published by Basic Books. Now, this isn't really a new book. The first edition came out in 1992, and it was republished in 2000 with a new introduction. But I chose it for the podcast because it provides such a succinct history of the changes of the American family and the myths that we often take for granted as being true about the so-called good old days. So perhaps just for today, we should call it the Relatively New Books in Sociology podcast, but in reality, this is a very timely issue, as we are still constantly bombarded by images and stories of either idyllic or nightmarish families, often with the implication that things were better in the past and that modernity has brought on family deterioration. In this book, Stephanie Coates outlines these myths and carefully destroys each one of them, while providing a more balanced and accurate depiction of what families were actually like in the glorious past that we have so idealized. She also provides a more realistic framework of the issues that modern families face today. Good morning, Stephanie.
Good morning.
We are talking today about your book, The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap. Tell me, what is the nostalgia trap and why is it a problem in our society?
Well, there is a tendency to look back at the past and think that things were rosier then. The more I study family history, the more I am respectful of the sort of things that first tend to trigger nostalgia, that people look around at what's going on in the present and they don't like it. They see things that are unfair or things that seem wrong to them. And without the tools to understand where those things came from or how they could be changed in the future, unfortunately, they tend to look backwards and to idealize the past. If we could just get back to that, things would be better. I've come to think of nostalgia as a misplaced critique of the present and desire for change. Unfortunately, a lot of the mass media and people with a stake a vested interest in the status quo tend to encourage that nostalgia because the solution, if it's nostalgia, is to turn the clock back rather than try to adjust to changing family life.
I see. Yeah. Why do you think it's such a persistent problem? I think the media is involved. Are there any other possible reasons?
Well, you know, I'm not one for saying that there's such a thing as human nature. I think human beings are very pliable, but I do think it is a tendency that you see throughout history. My gosh, back in the Roman Empire, they were looking back to the good old days when wives spent more time at the distaff, and the colonial Americans no sooner got off the boat than they were, complaining about the rising generation. So I do think there's a certain amount of that built into the way human beings process their memories, but I think it's very much encouraged by the mass media, and particularly the kind of nostalgia for the 1950s and 1960s, because that was a time period, just at that period was when the mass media came of age, and you began to see a really common audience. It was before the fragmentation of today. There were like three networks that people watched, so everybody was watching these kind of same shows. And over the years, even though the people who watched them at the time realized that the family life portrayed in Leave It to Beaver and Ozzie and Harriet had really nothing to do with what they had experienced just coming out of the Depression and World War II, it was what they would have liked to experience. And then their kids grew up thinking that was the traditional family. So it's been a particular problem with the 1950s family.
So it creates this sort of false memory.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. You also talk about the 1950s as being a rather unusual decade, even though we always think of it as when things were traditional and that before the 50s, everything was like it was in the 50s. But you said that's actually not true.
Well, it was arguably the least traditional decade in all of American history, barring, you know, extreme events like revolution and civil war. For example, many people think that the male breadwinner family is traditional. Actually, throughout most of history, for thousands of years, women brought home the bacon just as much as men did. But first of all, of course, they raised it on the farm, slaughtered it, and then the women cured it and usually took it to market. There was no concept that there was such a thing as a male provider family. Men and women work together in farms or small businesses, and in fact, some of my other books talk about the development of marriage, which was not based on love, but on expanding the family labor force. So it's really not until the 19th century that we get this idea that men and women have qualitatively different natures. It's an interesting idea because when I say that through most of history women were co-providers for their families, that did not give them equal say in their family. And in fact, in most of European history and elsewhere around the world, men own the product of women's labor. You know, the lovely old wedding vow, you know, where the guy says, with all my worldly goods, I thee endow. Well, actually, that should have been said by the woman, because upon marriage, he took ownership of her dowry, her inheritance, her jewels, even anything she earned within marriage. So women were not equal in this, but they were not seen as qualitatively different. What happens in the 19th century is very interesting. Women and men's roles are redefined so that now the argument is, well, no, there's no, we don't have this old style patriarchy where men just boss women around. It's just that men and women do different things. And women who had formerly been seen as shrewd in business and actually the lusty sex more prone to sexual error than men, and men who had been encouraged to participate in kin keeping and to show their emotions and to do things like arrange weddings for the in the community, suddenly men were defined as the instrumental, the provider, and women as the nurturer. However, in most families, you still did not have a single breadwinner. If a woman wasn't working beside her husband, then her children were going out to work. It wasn't until the 1920s that a bare majority of kids grew up in a male breadwinner family where their wife was not working and they were not working but were in school. That form of reform receded in the 30s and 40s. It roared back in the 50s and early 60s, but only lasted about 18 years. So it's really very non-traditional. So there are all sorts of other things about the 1950s that were non-traditional. And in fact, the more I study it, the more I can understand a certain nostalgia for the economic of the time if you were white. Now, let me say this did not apply to blacks. But
minor
if you were
detail.
White men, this was a period for the first time, really, where the income gap was closing, where real wages were falling even faster for the bottom 20% of earners than they were for the top. And by the end of the 50s, the average 30-year-old man could buy a median-priced home on 15 to 18% of his salary, which is, of course, unheard of today.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was this huge economic boost that was very atypical. It was the post-war prosperity combined with much more government investment in social programs and job creation than we see today. The problem, of course, when you look back and want to get nostalgic about it, is that blacks were left out of this and women were left out of it. I just finished a new book on women in the 1960s and their marriages and all these women who rushed into marriage. Well, that was the only way they could participate in the expanding consumer economy. Their wages were flat. There were very little options for women who wanted to work outside the home, certainly for anything more than a small amount of time. So you had women having to get married and having to stay married.
Right. Yeah. You talked about how in the 1950s there was an expansion of social programs, and that's part of the reason why we think of it as a nostalgic time in terms of it, you know, people having a better financial situation. You also said, I'm sorry, go on.
You go.
No, you said that that because of this, there's this sort of myth of self-reliance
that people don't realize how much, government programs actually helped families during that time. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Exactly. This was a time period when government was helping us in so many different ways. First of all, the investment in infrastructure, like highway building, factories, school building, which creates jobs, was going on at a rate 3.5 times what we see today. The federal highway program under Eisenhower, a total federal program that created all sorts of new jobs for working class Americans and opened up suburbia to middle class Americans. Meanwhile, all of the inventions that the government had financed during World War II, prefabricated housing, all the things that made so many consumer goods, and including homes, available for the first time to people, had been financed by government research, but were turned over to private industry, which was then able to sell them at a lower cost than it would have been without such government industry. Plus, of course, you had an incredible number of young men because of the draft. Only 2% of veterans were women, so that's why I say young men, who were eligible for veterans benefits. And they were quite generous. They paid they paid an allowance every month, but they also paid the tuition, no matter how high the tuition. And, of course, you had the new Fannie Mae and Ginnie Mae institutions that reorganized the private banking industry so that they accepted lower down payments and longer payoffs to make homes available, and some even offered a dollar down for veterans. So it was a time of tremendous investment in job creation and in the social kinds of stage on which people could begin to pull themselves up, not by their own bootstraps, but having a stepping stone to get up. Now, of course, the big problem is that if you were African American or Chicano or Native American, you were left out of that. Women were not included in it. And the other problem was that this was a good time to be a white working class or middle class family, if everything was going well in your family. But if it wasn't, if there was alcoholism or domestic violence, which was stunningly, just let's come back to that, how non-seriously it was taken. There was no such thing as marital rape. Divorce was still fault-based divorce. You had to prove that not only had your spouse done something egregiously wrong, which was easier to prove against women than men, by the way, but that you came to court, the way the judges put it, with clean hands. So if there was something wrong in your family, there was nowhere to go because these things were systematically swept under the rug. So that's why you don't really want to be nostalgic for that period.
Right. It's not as great as it was cracked up to be. Can you tell us why there's a myth today of parental omnipotence, or feeling that, that this sort of break between, your emotional life being sort of relegated to the home, and how that was different before?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by omnipotence, because it seems to me that most parents feel terribly out of touch and frightened by the new world that their kids are entering, both the technology, the new sexual mores, the availability of things like pornography on the net, and, of course, the falling opportunity to succeed in traditional middle-class occupations, what many economists have called the hollowing out of the job and income structure. And so I think what happens is that parents have, especially middle-class, college-educated parents, have become increasingly frantic about overseeing their kids, preventing them from falling off and out and down from the middle class. And this is actually much more intense than it was in the 50s. In some ways, it's of course, good to be concerned about your kids' development. More people read to their kids. We're much more conscious about accidents, and the accident rate has gone way down since the 1950s. We've solved many of the medical problems that used to be an issue for kids. And in many ways, the intensive involvement with children is good for them, but it can cross a line very easily, and I think it does cross that line for parents who become what they call helicopter parents. And I think, though, that there are structural reasons for that, that the new economic inequality, the new job insecurity, and the tremendous actual lack of mobility in America compared to many other countries. That's one of the another big myths about America is that we have more social and economic mobility. I think this really scares parents, and this is why they have become so obsessed with following, monitoring, and screening, grooming their children.
Right. Well, you talk about in your book as well about how this kind of nostalgia for the 1950s as the home being the foundation of our society kind of leaves, people that really believe in that ideal kind of isolates families from a feeling of being part of a larger society.
It does, and this sense that the home is a refuge has a lot of different, it plays out not only through the 50s, but throughout American history. And it's ironic because a lot of people today look at the, number of working moms and think, oh my goodness, let's go back to the 50s where kids were more protected within the home and had more time with their parents. But actually, very careful time diary studies of several sociologists show us that parents today are spending much more time with their kids than they did at the height of the male breadwinner family. And they don't park them in front of the TV or let them go out and play in ways that they could, by the way. I have to say, if you lived in the suburbs and everybody had moved to the suburbs at the same time and had kids the same age, it was a lot easier to just let your kids go out and play with other kids. But in terms of time parents spend with kids, that's actually gone up, not down. When women first started entering the workforce, their time with kids did decrease a little. And during that era, when a wife took a job, a man did not increase his time at childcare. But since 1985, women have increased their childcare hours to the point where, even though employed women spend a little less time than homemaker women with their kids, they spend more time than homemakers did in the early 1960s, in the 50s and 60s. And today, when a woman takes a job, most men step up to the plate and show much more parental knowledge and much more parental involvement. They've tripled the amount of child care they've done in the last 10 years alone. 20 years alone. So this kind of idea that the family used to be self-reliant. Now, what you said about that mythology about being self-reliant, cutting us off from other ties, that trend goes very long, far back in American history. We tend to romanticize marriage and the nuclear family more than most of our European counterparts. Mm-hmm. And I think that's partly because we have the mythology that we just talked about a little earlier, the mythology of laissez-faire individualism, and that everybody can and should do it alone, and that basically there should be no regulation other than that required to keep crime down, that we don't invest. Whereas, countries in Europe are much more inclined to invest in parks rather than tell parents, save up enough money so you can buy a new home in a place where there are places where your kids can play. And to the extent I think that we have emphasized this sort of competitive capitalism everywhere else, this free market run amok, some would say, in every other area of life, we have sort of stuffed all the altruism, all the sense of obligation, and mutual kind of regulation and control that is spread more evenly in other countries. We stuffed it into the family, which can have antisocial effects. Naomi Gerstle and her colleagues, for example, studied married versus singles fairly recently, and they discovered that far from being the building blocks of the community, married couples are more cut off from the community than their single counterparts. They're less likely to spend time giving practical aid to their parents, to kin, and neighbors. They spend less time socializing, except in very narrow circles when their kids are very young, with the play dates. But aside from that, Naomi describes marriage as a greedy institution that sucks people away from their involvement elsewhere.
And this wasn't always the case.
No, back in colonial days, the married couple was indeed the building block of the community. Single people, bachelors and visitors were expected to be placed in the homes of married couples. Married couples organized the social life of the community. Men more than women engaged in matchmaking, you know. At that time, yes, it was a distinct reversal. There has been a distinct reversal since the pre-modern era.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It reminds me of how, you know, at least with most young people today, when somebody starts to date, like when you have a group of friends and someone starts to date someone, it's sort of expected that you're going to not hear from that person very much anymore. You know, it's like, well, now they're in a relationship and this is sort of something, you know, especially when they get married. But even before that, there's a sense of, you know, well, that's sacred and now they need to be alone.
Yes, I think that's true, although I think that we are seeing young people experiment with alternatives as the age of marriage continues to rise and people understand that although the divorce rate has been falling for the past 20 years, divorce is still certainly a possibility. I think that young people are beginning to understand the importance of developing social support networks beyond your immediate partner. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's one of the reasons you have the hookup phenomenon that so shocks older people. And I'm old enough that I don't totally understand it, but looking at it as a historian, I think, you know, these young people are trying to come to terms with a world where they are not, where they're obviously, they're not going to marry until their late 20s, even into their 30s. They've obviously hit their sexual maturity much younger than that. But they need to develop friendships with the opposite sex, not just an ongoing partnership that's going to end in marriage. Mm-hmm. And whatever it's problems, I see this kind of hanging out and then occasionally hooking up as part of an attempt to negotiate a completely new sequence of getting involved in sex, of developing friends, and eventually moving on to a dyadic relationship.
Interesting. You talk about the thing that you mentioned before about how our modern society, our feelings of altruism, everything is sort of stuffed into the family as if that were supposed to be the emotional center of our, you know, existence. And you, in your book, you kind of talk a little bit about how this relates to politicians and our view of their personal versus their public lives. Could you talk a little bit about that? You mentioned the Clinton sex scandal and...
Well, I think that a couple of things are going on here. One is, of course, that we just have a news media that prefers to focus on personal scandals because those don't require any kind of analysis. So they're not going to piss off either side. So if you have to analyze, you know, where this economic corruption came from or who lied to what lobbyist, you begin to really stir the pot in terms of a lot of vested interest. But the other side of it, I think, comes in, and since I wrote The Way We Never Were, I also did a big history of marriage. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of myths connected to marriage, too, that we used to do marriage better and people used to respect their marriage vows more than they do today. And, of course, that's not true at all. Actually, there was, especially for men, much more tolerance of extramarital affairs. So I think that another thing that's happening is that at the same time as relationships are harder to sustain over the long run, we have much higher expectations of them and much fairer expectations of them. So I think there's also a certain amount of fascination with, well, how do you handle it when your spouse behaves this way? And so I think it's a very complex issue.
What are some of the myths about African-American families that you discuss in your book?
Well, of course, there's the continuing myth that black families are The whole Moynihan myth, that they're matriarchal, that they're disorganized, they're dysfunctional. When we look back in history, we find, of course, tremendous strength of black families, including not only, you know, a real commitment to kin, but also a real commitment to fictive kin, which you basically had to have during slavery. And in many, populations that have experienced economic hardship and discrimination, it's really important to develop social networks beyond the nuclear family. So in many ways, I think what people are misinterpreting as a lack of family ties is a more extended kin orientation traditionally among African-American families above a conjugal orientation, you know, an orientation just toward your particular spouse.
Mm-hmm.
So in my book, I try to talk about some of the myths about, black matriarchy, about disorganized black families, and point out their tremendous history and some of the real strengths and resilience. There are real problems in the black community, in the impoverished part of the black community. Since that book first came out, you've seen a real interesting and increased bifurcation of class within the African American community. And I think that it's affected racial feelings among whites in a particular way, so that in one sense you have almost a colorblind racism that says, Obama is okay because he speaks like a white middle class educated guy, but these guys who hang out on corners and use different jargon, they're the ones we worry about. So this race thing is a continually evolving thing. As late as 1970, race and gender trumped class and education in determining wages, for example. 1970, a white female college graduate or a black college graduate earned less than the average white male high school graduate. Today, education and class outweigh race and gender. But race and gender, both, but particularly race, have these accumulated disadvantages that makes many African Americans, give them less access to good schooling, less access to the sorts of things that can be translated now much more than in the past into success, individual success in our society. So we're still struggling with those things as well. One of the things I found out, did a lot of research on more recently when I was studying marriages in the early 1960s, is that the whole concept, there's this myth, that the conservative myth we've been talking about black family disorganization and crime and all of that, that I tried to counter in the book about The Way We Never Were. But there is a myth among liberals, too, that somehow feminism is irrelevant to African Americans and that they've not been supportive of feminism. In fact, even when black women did not have to work outside the home, Bart Landry has found that in the 1950s, white women married to upper middle class white men were the least likely to work outside the home, but black women married to upper middle class men were the most likely to work outside the home, and they often did so because they wanted to. It was African American leaders, not feminist leaders, who first coined the idea of being co-providers and having a tripart identity of wife and mother, community activist, and breadwinner for the family. So I think that's another very important strength of African American communities and African American history. It did not produce matriarchy. It produced more equality. Obviously, there are gender differences and inequality in the black community as well, but they have a much longer tradition of co-providing than white Americans do.
Wow, that's really interesting. You also talked about how part of our, of our feelings of nostalgia come from the fact that we do get a distorted picture, not just of what happened in the past, but of what's happening now. You talk about how the media kind of covers things more sensationally, and we believe, for example, that, the crime rates have gone up when they've actually gone down. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. You know, there's this tendency among the media to just throw factoids, you know, or to catch factoids. Actually, that might be a better way to think about it, because there are all of these ideologically informed think tanks that often don't even have family researchers on their staff, who cherry pick evidence to increase their idea of nostalgia, that families are in decline, that we have to roll back whatever their particular issue is. We have to roll back same-sex marriage. We have to, you know, reinstitutionalize divorce, make divorce harder to get. We've got to reinstitutionalize illegitimacy so that people don't have kids out of wedlock. And they're always throwing out these facts to show you, to prove how the world is going to hell in a handbasket. Certainly, mm-hmm. we face many new problems, but what's fascinating and gets overlooked and is that in many of the problems that we had in the 80s actually were among teenagers who had been born into male breadwinner families in the 50s. And one of the things we've seen, especially since the beginning of the 90s, is an incredible decline. I have an intern working with me at the Council on Contemporary Families now. We'll be able to put out a graph in the next couple of weeks showing that there's been almost a 75% decline in self-reported sexual victimization rates of women. There's been a huge decline in teen pregnancy. There's been rates of teen violence are and murder are as low as they were in 1966. So although we have many issues facing us in America, and I'm not about to say, okay, everything is going great. I think there are serious family and social issues. Mm-hmm. The idea that somehow these are all caused by the changes, by the increased family diversity and the increased options mm-hmm. to live outside a lifelong early marriage nuclear family mm-hmm. just doesn't hold water.
Right. Yeah, you said that a lot of people, when they, you know, see some of the problems today or the alleged problems that they hear on the media, they blame feminism for it, as if feminism caused these things. But you argue that there haven't been enough changes, and that is why many women are unhappy today.
Well, you know, again, let me refer to some other research I did for another book on the feminine mystique, and which was Betty Friedan wrote in 1963, and which just had a tremendous effect on many, many women. Well, you go back to 1963. You know, this is, you know, after the 1950s, and you look at what the law and the social practices were like for women. There were still sex-segregated want ads, help wanted female, help wanted male. It was perfectly legal to pay women less for the same job than men and to exclude them from many desirable jobs. Mm-hmm. And so the idea, for example, that homemakers were better off then, that is absurd. There were only 8 states where a homemaker had any claim at all upon the income that her husband earned during the marriage in the case of a divorce. And even in those 8 community property states, the man had the ability to decide what would be done with the community property, and even in most of them to alienate it without her consent. That didn't end until 1974, when a Louisiana man who was in jail for molesting his daughter sold his family home to pay for his defense. And at that point, the Louisiana state court said, no, maybe this is not something we should allow. Back in those days, there was no such thing as marital rape. As I've said, domestic violence was not taken seriously. In fact, one of the few scientific studies I could find that came out in 1964 and described, actually did case studies of domestic violence, actually said that in many cases, it despite, you know, its problems, it did establish a more or less satisfactory equilibrium in families that had been disrupted by the female's overassertion. And so she was happier and her husband was happier when he beat her. So this
nice.
Is the sort of thing that prevailed then. Feminism has freed women from this. It's also led to an increase, to a decrease in child poverty. It's allowed men and women to escape abusive marriages. And by the way, a lot of people complain about divorce, and divorce has some serious problems, but it also is sometimes the solution to even more serious problems. In every state that adopted no-fault divorce, and they adopted it at different times, so two economists had the chance to actually evaluate what happened. Each of those states in the following 5 years, yes, did see a surge in divorce. It also saw an 8 to 13% decline in wives' suicide rates and a 30% decline in domestic violence. And, of course, since that time, actually, divorce rates have been going down, and they've been going down the most among educated couples who subscribe to more tradition, to more unconventional family values, more egalitarian male-female relations. That's been good for men, too, that men no longer have to be the only providers. And, you know, many of the men that I interviewed when I was interviewing women and men who read The Feminine Mystique told me that the problems for women with the feminine, with the mystiques about gender roles, kicked in when women were told, when they turned about 24 or 25, they'd been told, you will be totally happy for the rest of your life as soon as you find a good provider and a couple of kids. And when they weren't, they could look around, and at first they internalized it, thought something was wrong with them, but once feminism came along, they could actually still had time to change their life course. Several men I interviewed said, you know, for me, I had been told that all my happiness would come when I got my gold watch and my retirement. As long as I was a good provider all these years, the rest of my life would be just golden. And he said, you know, they said I would come home and I was stranger to my wife and children. But it was too late for me to change the course of my life. So feminism has been good for men as well as women.
Wow. Yeah. What do you think is behind the kind of something that tends to be very common in my generation of women saying, trying to sort of believing or taking advantage of the things that feminism has, you know, offered us and that women of other generations have fought for us to have, and yet also trying to distance oneself from feminism? Because I hear that a lot of the I'm not a feminist, but, you know, blah, blah, blah. Where do you think that comes from?
Well, again, I think it's complicated. Part of it is the relentless media drama and social conservative drama that feminists are anti-men, they're anti-family. Then there is also the impression that feminists are anti-sex. And that's a complicated thing, too, because I do think that when women of my age and generation were just beginning to enter the workforce, we really had to be very, very careful not to do anything. I mean, sexual harassment wasn't even illegal back in the early 1970s and late 60s. And so you had to be very careful how you dressed, how you appeared. Women today feel more free, and some of them, I think, take the, you know, believe that we were prudish because of the way we behaved. On the other hand, so that part of it I can understand. On the other hand, I do think that young women have often been sucked into a sort of new media hype, a new kind of feminine mystique that I call the hottie mystique, that you're supposed to display your sexuality at all times. But another reason, so I think there are good and bad reasons that young women are worried about feminism from the point of view of sexuality. Another reason that people, though I think don't call themselves feminists, is that things are a little more complex now in terms of class. What we're, you know, in a sense, in the 60s, we picked the low-hanging fruit when we went up against the laws that blatantly discriminated against women. Now you're seeing the class differences among women come to the fore, and I think that there's some confusion about what feminism really means. You have Sarah Palin and people calling the Susan B. Anthony, you know, we're feminists because we oppose abortion and contraception rights. You have the power feminists who really basically want there to be, you know, they want to crack the glass ceiling, and they don't pay much attention to the basement floor where many working class men are stuck doing the dirty work among the boiler rooms. So there's a lot of reasons, I think, that people, for good and bad, that people are confused about what feminism is. And I have to say, since I'm speaking to a sociologist, that some of the academic feminists with their kind of jargon, it's supposedly, you know, the sort of postmodern jargon is supposedly about highlighting sex and race and gender and class. But in fact, it cuts us off from talking to real people where they really are. So all of these things come into play. Part of it is the right-wing myths about feminism. Part of it is the ambivalence of young women who find that that equality doesn't give them equality in legal terms, still has all sorts of issues that are attached to it and that are very difficult to negotiate it. And part of it is the increasing salience of class in our society that divides women as well as men.
So what you said in terms of sociologists kind of making the discourse very sort of academic or non-accessible?
Well, you know, we all do it. Historians do it, too.
Yeah.
And I work, but I'll just tell you, for example, in a public talk, I would never use the word discourse. It's not something that most class audiences, not a word they use.
Good point.
And that's my one of my passions. I work with a group called the Council on Contemporary Families, and we have many sociologists. Frank Furstenberg was one of the founding members. Constance Ahrens, Barbara Rissman at UIC is still our executive officer. And one of our passions is to get other sociologists and historians and academics to translate their research into plain English so that people can understand, to go public. And we spend a lot of time. In fact, if you're interested, you should go to the Contemporary Families website. We spend a lot of time taking new research and putting it into words that the press can understand and getting those out. So I'm a big believer in that. If we're fortunate enough to be paid, sometimes underpaid perhaps, but still to be paid to do this kind of research, we should be taking it public. We should not be standing back and letting people who are not trained in research but have an ideological agenda throw these little factoids, to get back to our previous question and answer, at the media and have the media tell us, oh, my goodness, you know, divorce is ruining America or whatever it is. We should be sharing our research.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Sometimes I think when you're kind of, you know, in a field for a while, you think that is regular language and you don't realize that it isn't because you're just in there. And it seems like a lot of these myths are perpetuated because people do take things for granted. And when we hear things, you know, from the media, we just kind of, they just become embedded in our minds. Do you see any hope for that changing? Because outside of, you know, I mean, where people are talking about books and things like that, but a lot of people don't access those, you know, those sites or these interviews, or most people just watch the regular mainstream media. Do you see hope for that changing anytime soon?
Well, since I wrote this particular book we've been talking about, The Way We Never Were, I've seen progress in some area and setbacks in another. I think I've seen real hope in terms of understanding the public's ability to understand and accept family diversity. People are much more, in the last 15 or 20 years, people have raised their standards about marriage, but simultaneously been more understanding of why people leave a marriage that does not work well, or why a woman, what it is to cohabit outside of marriage, that's not necessary. I think we've made real progress in getting people at a gut level to understand the difference between cause and correlation, that just because more single-parent families live in poverty, that might be a result of poverty, not necessarily the cause of poverty, or that some more complex interaction may be occurring. I've seen tremendous progress in that. You see it perhaps the most in the rapid change in acceptance of same-sex marriage. For the first time last year, a plurality of Americans, more of them supported same-sex marriage than opposed it. And so I think we're seeing growing acceptance of diversity, growing tolerance. At the same time, where I have not seen improvement and maybe even backtracking is in the understanding of a myth we talked about earlier in the conversation, the myth of self-reliance. That people have looked at the ways that the state can go wrong when it is overly influenced by private enterprise, by lobbyists who go in and deform the laws and the taxation systems and the regulation and the way things are carried out. And they've been translating that with great, you know, tremendous encouragement from Tea Party types into the idea that the state can't solve anything under any conditions, and that we should just back off and let the free enterprise market reign. So I've actually seen seen real regression in that part of the American dialogue. So it's interesting. There's been, I think, progress in our ability to discuss family life more rationally, less moralistically, but been some real setbacks in our ability to understand the pros and cons of state intervention and when it is necessary.
Right. Okay. Well, we've taken up enough of your time. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's really been my pleasure. Thank you. It was a fun conversation.
You have just listened to an interview with author Stephanie Kuntz on her book, The Way We Never Were, American Families and the Nostalgia Trap. This is Annie Sabukaya with New Books in Sociology. Thank you for being with us today.